Nothing more innately human than humming a tune, especially when it's made by actual humans. Don't bother trying to see the Velvet Sundown in concert. The band doesn't exist. The sounds are produced by artificial intelligence. Worse, most listeners can't tell the difference with the real thing. With computers borrowing from real musicians for their inspiration, we'll weigh the implications. And if humans are going to continue to rule artistic creation, then our panel needs to answer one simple question. What makes a hit song? Sometimes it's a gorgeous melody, a brilliant arrangement. Sometimes it's an annoyingly easy to remember brainworm that'll stay in your head long after you wish it had departed. We promised to spare you a recording of Baby Shark, but either way, what makes a song special? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking, what makes a hit? And if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, why not subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. With us today for this show, she'll be at the Sunside here in Paris on December 19th. The other side of the festive season, you're at Burt's Jazz Bar in Belfast. Paris-based vocalist and songwriter Liv Monahan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
His next gig is right here in the French capital in the 20th arrondissement, is that correct?
Yes.
With his pop duo Faux Amis. Pianist and composer Richard Sears. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
With us as well, he knows music, he knows algorithms as well, but does he know what makes a hit? Ulysse Hennessy is a managing director of the industry magazine Billboard France. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And she definitely knows a good thing when she hears it. Disc jockey, radio host, and France 24 music critic, Marjorie Hash. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. Throughout the year, yeah, you can listen wherever podcasts are streamed. Music platforms are inundated. More than 10,000 tracks a day churned out on the cheap by artificial intelligence. Music or noise? Turns out it's hard to tell, reports Camille Knight.
Artificial intelligence is shaking up the music industry, and a lot of us can't even hear it happening. One study shows 97% of people can't tell the difference between a track generated by AI and one created by a human. So let's put it to the test. Passers-by were played two songs, one by an actual American artist, the other by artificial intelligence.
You can kick rocks if you don't like how I talk. I'm gonna keep on talking and walk my walk.
I think the first one's AI and the second one isn't.
It's the total opposite.
Wow.
It's really hard to tell.
It's kind of scary. I can't tell the difference between the two at all. It's terrifying.
The rise of AI music is growing, and fast. At Deezer, which receives a million new songs every week, the number of AI-generated tracks is soaring.
In January, 10% of that weekly million were songs entirely generated by AI. Today, that figure has risen to 34%. That means 340,000 fully AI-generated songs are now arriving in our catalogue every week.
For a year now, the platform has been using a tool capable of detecting AI-generated content. Most are low-quality songs churned out in large quantities to generate revenue. Those are deleted almost immediately. The others can remain on the platform but are flagged with an AI-generated tag. It doesn't stop some of them from becoming a huge success, though, like this song by a fake band which fooled listeners with a hit last summer. As for this song listened to earlier, it made history this month as the first AI-generated song to top a Billboard chart.
Yeah, that song by, again, I don't know if you call it a group or the name of a group is breaking rust. The sixth artist, to break into the Billboard charts in 2025. Again, if you want to call them artists, we can show you some of the comments section on YouTube below the song. There's Dan the drummer saying, I bet that guy in the distance has like six messed up fingers. Easy State writes, that's tough talk from an algorithm. While Orange Web 3 creators adds, bought tickets to their live concerts from some AI ticket agent who phoned me. Seems legit, cannot wait. So a bit of fun, but actually, is it funny, Richard Sears?
I think it's terrifying, though. I'm not so concerned, though. I feel the more we see of this, the more our desire to experience music live and feel the music is grows. I mean, it's a feeling that can't be replaced, and I think as we're more confused by what we're seeing, we want the real thing more.
But these AI songs are made using real sounds. Do you fear that your blood, sweat, and tears that goes into songwriting and to composing and to recording is then stolen and used by these algorithms?
Yeah, I think this will have a negative effect for artists who make a living doing this and who are putting their energy this direction. I find some part of it can be interesting, the way that AI can be used on the production level by humans to help form a song, to help form the material, like at the mixing stage or the mastering stage. But the final creation being all AI, it's terrifying.
Are you terrified, Liv?
I mean, I don't know if I would say I'm terrified, because I see songwriting as ultimately so human. I just don't know why would anyone really be interested in listening to music in the same way if it's all generated by AI and robots. You know, like, I think the reason I'm a songwriter is because I'm writing about my human experiences, and I love listening to other songwriters for the same reason. So what's the point if, you know, if there isn't a human behind this?
Yeah, for the listener, yes. But yeah. What about the promoter? He doesn't have to pay Liv Donovan, doesn't have to get her to book her a plane ticket, he doesn't have to...
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it's changing. I think because where I'm at, I'm doing everything, so I've managed to stay small and do everything organically still. But sure, there's a lot of change, and that is... I just don't know if being terrified is the right thing. You know, I think we're going to have to see how it goes. And, you know, like Richard said, there's some tools that we can use with AI. It's how are we going to make it work to our advantage, but also making sure that people are educated on what's happening. And again, you know, I think it's what musicians are always saying. We need to support musicians. People need to be aware of how they're supporting musicians and how music is being supported. Does that make sense? Mm.
Ulysse Hennessy, you're not terrified.
No, not really, and I completely agree with the point made before. We've seen two phenomena with the rise of AI music. First, a huge surge of live music, and we've seen record-breaking numbers in the live industry. And the second thing we've seen, and I think it goes with the argument of like organic music and the need for organic music, is the fact that people tend to turn actually to more older catalog with the rise of AI music, which, in my opinion, means that they want something that seems real and that they have the authenticity of, you know.
But there is, again, a lot of scammers, and we saw in that report some of them are easy to find. A few years ago, by the way, we did a show on how scammers were peddling badly written, highly inaccurate computer-generated books on Amazon. But they were pilfering the research and writing of actual authors. Turns out the same is true for music. Up to 70% of the streams generated by fully AI-generated tracks, according to Deezer, are in fact fraudulent. And so those are excluded. But then there's this kind of gray area.
That's true. Actually, your number is true. But according to Goldman Sachs' latest report, only 0.1% of the total royalties in the music industry go to AI-generated tracks. So it means that it's the 70% of the 0.1% that is fraudulent. But I actually agree with your point. It's that a lot of AI-generated tracks are made with a fraudulent goal. And that is true. There are some scammers. But I think it's a separate debate in this question.
And just one last point on this. You talk about, well, people want the live experience, but wasn't that already the case 2 decades ago when the internet kind of broke the whole business model of selling CDs and selling records?
But actually, the numbers are way higher right now. For instance, I can take a recent example here in France. So Stade de France, which is France's biggest venue.
80,000 seats.
Exactly. It broke its record for the year with the most concerts in 1 year. For 2026, and all concerts of 2026 have not been announced yet. And the record had already been broken in 2025.
So, Marjorie Hash?
I agree. Music and live music is something that's super important right now. And I think young people are going to save their money to go to those big concert venues like Stade de France. I think where I'm more concerned is on a smaller level, because there's people who, bands who are trying to make money through touring, etc. They're having a really hard time. They're often going to tour at a loss. This is kind of concerning because they're not making money through selling records, particularly if it's streaming. And then now it's maybe through merch to some extent.
And their streaming has to compete again with these
Absolutely.
Things that are either completely AI or partially AI.
And
right?
I think it's problematic in some streaming platforms where they're not maybe as mindful about kind of flagging up the AI-generated music, or they're going to infuse it in playlists and so on. And so that's taking up the space of, I guess, real artists or human being artists, and the amount of music getting played out, because automatically, for just to Spotify, who are the worst at paying artists, for example, well, if they're infusing AI, that's another person they don't have to pay.
And Spotify has not yet done what Deezer is doing, this labels to say this is AI generated, or they're doing it?
I think they're starting to, but they're like, it's the fact that they infuse it into playlists. And I think a lot of those streaming platforms, it's what playlists you end up being in, and playlists that people are going to listen to. And so I think that affects the number of streams as well. So if it's diluted with AI generated music, is it fair?
And of course, that brings us to the essential question, which is, if you're going to make it out there, you need a hit. There's an episode of the hit TV show The Sopranos where made man Christopher tries to peddle a song recorded by his fiance to long in the tooth music producer Hesh. He listens and says, there's one constant in the music business. A hit is a hit, and this is not a hit for reasons we cannot comprehend or qualify. Cannot comprehend or qualify? Or is there a recipe for a hit? Lived on it.
Is there a recipe for a hit? Like, there definitely are formulas that people can follow, but I'll come back to the, you know, there's always a bit of je ne sais quoi or some magic inside, to make a hit, I think. Now, you might disagree with me with the... I don't know. I'm still coming at it from a very pure sense. There is a formula. There's a musical formula for pop hits. And Richard and myself come from more of a jazz background. So I think sometimes, if Richard will agree, there is a kind of a relatively simple formula for pop hits with certain chords that people are used to listening to. And there's a comfort.
So familiarity.
Familiarity, absolutely. Not being too surprised. I think that's one of the reasons why people don't, like, there isn't a huge jazz following, like there is a pop following. The earworms, like you spoke about, is a really important thing. So a good hook. And I will say again, great lyrics, like some kind of a hook that can be also in the lyrics, but there has to be something else as well. In my opinion, there has to be something else.
And
to
what
make
is
it.
That something else? It's... Richard Sears, tell us.
I agree with Liv, and I think another part of that is the way that pop hits betray convention, and how something
so they're transgressive.
Yeah, I think sometimes. I think that's a big part of it. Sometimes, like. Just to use a current example, the singer Cameron Winter, whose ascendant right now is his voice. The first time I heard it, I never really thought that could be a pop voice, and I was so surprised by it that I just found myself wanting to hear it more. I think it's our desire to hear something new, and how that kind of fits into convention is the paradox of writing pop.
Because your writing saddles two genres, right? You do jazz music, that's where you come from, but you also write pop songs. Is it two different skills?
I'm answering that question for myself every day. But yeah, there's a part of me from the jazz world where I'm like obsessed with chords and harmony and melody, and for me, writing is this is always an exploration of those values, and then the pop part of it is I think binding it together and finding something that. Is the thread that kind of binds it together.
Mm. The thread that binds it together. Marjorie, a hit is a hit?
Yeah, I think the Beatles kind of summed it up well, because when they were composing their own music, I think they had to make, they wrote tracks or pop songs that were easy to remember. And that was the way they kind of started doing it. And I think that probably trickled down into the audience, and you know, they had their career span 10 years of hits after hits after hits, and I think they're the ultimate pop band on that time. So maybe that's the key to success, is also writing something that will stick in your ear and that you can remember yourself. And,
so there's two schools of thoughts when it comes to the Beatles, Liv Monahan. One is that, yeah, easy to remember tunes, and the other is competitiveness, that John Lennon and Paul McCartney were friends, but rivals as well, and so they had to always outdo each other.
Absolutely, that's great, isn't it? Kind of, you know, egged each other on. I think that's also what made them great, isn't it? You know, there was that sense. It gives a sense of tension, which is also another component that I think is really important in something like that. Like you feel that, and that sense of competitiveness is really, really important in the music industry and in any kind of art like that. You know, it's the same across the board, you know. So it's wonderful that they were both in the same group, obviously.
Ulysse Hennessy, is a hit throughout the world?
Throughout the world? No. I think there are global hits, but most hits, and especially right now in the streaming era, there are local hits.
Local hits.
Yeah, like that's what we've seen with like streaming. Actually, is like despite all the songs of the world being available to everyone, is that people tend to listen more to artists of their own country, and that's what we've seen, for instance, in France. With like last week, Spotify released the data of the most listened artists in the country, and there were 10 French-speaking artists.
Out of
10.
10 out of 10.
Yeah.
And
Deezer released the same data, and it was 9 out of 10.
Wow. So does it work as well? So does it work that you've more of a chance in Ireland or in the UK than you would here?
Well, maybe, given that it sounds like it. I don't know, though. I think there's also that sense of you have the stats now, so I'm just talking again, you know, with my own feeling. But isn't there also a sense of being fascinated by the other? You know, I think that I know in Ireland we love a bit of French music because it's so different.
Yeah, Marjorie, you know? Right now in the UK there's a newfound fascination with country music because of the Beyoncé album.
I think it started a bit before, but, to be honest. But there's a few.
But that's certainly not British, is it?
No, but there are a lot of artists like C-Mat, who's Irish, who really mixes pop and country, and she's like having a big moment right now, particularly in the UK. And I think there's the fun storytelling that's really important, and it also throws back to traditional Scottish or Irish music as well. That there's obviously they're all interlinked if you go far back in the history of country music and how that was built through all the people migrating to the US, be they from Africa to Europe and so on. So I think there's something comforting in the storytelling.
The composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein once said that all music is folk music. So following up from what Marjorie said, would you agree with that, Richard Sears, that actually people want to hear their stories?
Yeah, that's funny. I knew that Leonard Bernstein was a big fan of the avant-garde saxophonist Ornette Coleman, and Ornette thought of his music as not jazz, but folk music. And I like that sentiment. I think if the music is paying attention to its own origins, then that's a good way of thinking about it.
How far back do you go, Liv, when you write?
Oh, do you mean like what?
Like personally, to the Renaissance, to the Middle Ages, how far back?
Oh, that's such a nice question. Sometimes I go way back. I'll go back to, you know, Irish inspirations back to the like 1500s, 1400s. I look at songs from that tradition and it definitely will inspire my work. But again, that's folk as well, isn't it? Because I suppose to link into what you're saying, I know my own culture best, you know, so that's what I'm able to write best about then as well.
The oldest song on record comes from a 13th century BC tablet in what is now called Syria. The Hurrian hymn refers to offerings and libations to the moon goddess Nikal. The Hurrian hymn, transcribed for all to play, performed here by Syrian pianist and composer Malik Jandali. And that's also, I guess, an important aspect is, again, this question of what is universal and what is immemorial, Marjorie Hash.
I think if it's definitely something that's talking to people and kind of connecting people through something that people relate to, I think that's important. Just going back to the storytelling, the folk side, if we're looking at people who've had recent hits, I was thinking of Charlie XCX, who had a big Bratz era that's just arrived, but or Lily Allen, and they're very good at storytelling and describing things how their peers and how young people feel. So I think there's something that's connected in that sense.
Both of you must be very bored of this question. I don't know who goes first. Is it first the words, then the music, or is it first the music, then the words?
Well, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, I don't have a rule there. I actually always used to hear melodies in my head, and I have a big book. I'm very old-fashioned of all of my lyrics and thoughts, and then I'd attach them to the melody.
And so you write down lyrics?
I write down lyrics completely separately. So I have like books, catalogues of lyrics, and then the music comes. That's always, and then it started to shift. Then I would have these books and I would then take the words and create music for the words. So both.
Same method, Richard?
No, I only write pop with one person named Noe Boone, and he's a lyricist, a guitarist, and he's part of my duo. And it changes from song to song, but it always starts with a musical idea that I might be working out, he might be working out, and a lyric that he might be wrestling with, and we wrestle the idea together.
So he's Mr. Lyrics.
Yeah, he's Mr. Lyrics. I feel I have no authority in that department.
Well, if you want to write a hit song, a surefire way to increase your odds of making it big is to make it about, well, that's right, Christmas. Irving Berlin's White Christmas, sung by Bing Crosby in the 1942 movie Holiday Inn, remains by far the most purchased song in history. In fact, three of the top five all-time most sold singles are in fact Christmas songs, Ulysse Hennessy. What is it about Christmas songs?
I think it's something that's universal, and as you said, it's the thing that works the most. And I think the second theme behind Christmas would be love, obviously, which is the most universal theme. And that's where something lies, you know, talking to anyone with the words that can touch anyone, I think.
But what is it about Christmas specifically? Is there something?
But Christmas is especially linked to English-speaking countries, I would say. Like, for instance, the USA, the United Kingdom. This phenomenon, you don't see it that much, for instance, in France.
Tino Rossi.
That's true, but that's more like of an exception than of a regular phenomenon. Whereas, for instance, if you check global Spotify charts, UK charts, All I Want for Christmas Is You of Mariah Carey will always come at the top at Christmas, which is not usually the case in France.
Right. So, Liv, if you're short a few bob, are you Christmas songs a good way to go?
I think so. Yeah, I think it definitely is a good way to go. You just need to be prepared well in advance. You have to start writing the Christmas song probably around March, you know. So it depends how you're, if you're really, you know, I'm not great for being able to get myself into the spirit when it's not the time. But it's definitely a good way to make a few bob, like you say.
And are they great songs, or are they, again, these earworms, Marjorie Ash?
I think All I Want for Christmas Is You is fantastic as a Christmas song. Apparently Mariah Carey had to decorate, it was in the summer, and she had to decorate her whole house the style to get the inspo to write it. So, and she's got a lot of humour about that song. You see it with, like, adverts, or every year she goes, it's time. And I think she's managed to keep that song going. Also, interestingly, the UK, as you were saying, the difference between France, the UK Christmas number one is a big deal. So any band who's trying to get the Christmas number one, that's really, like, you know, put forward as something important. Whereas, yeah, in France, no.
But something that is the same is that experience when you walk into a shopping mall in the month of December here in France. It's the same songs.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think generally it's just not this sort of appeal, or it's never been, like, put forward as a chart thing. I don't think the charts are such a big event in the UK, and the Christmas charts in particular, so maybe that's why.
Are there songs that are for other seasons, Richard? Or do you think that certain kinds of music are better suited to different times of the year?
Oh, wow. Songs for other seasons. I don't know. We need Vivaldi on the show for that question.
he's otherwise taken. Marjorie Hash, you did spot a trend on TikTok, how it's introduced a whole new generation, not just to Bing Crosby, but to 80s and 90s shoegaze rockers, My Bloody Valentine. All right, that's just one example. Tell us about this, Marjorie.
Oh, yes, it's interesting because we've noticed over the last 5 years that TikTok trends have really played an important part in terms of maybe educating younger people who will be like suddenly like, oh, Talking Heads, you know, or, the Fleetwood Mac as well had a big moment because of a trend on TikTok. And you could use that for series and that are kind of trickling down into TikTok, like Goo Goo Milk by The Cramps, which was a big feature on the TV show Wednesday. And what's interesting in the case of My Bloody Valentine, so they're like a big shoegaze band from the 80s. They don't really court popularity, or they don't do much promo.
I mean, I knew them because of independent radio in college and stuff, but they were not mainstream in
the
80s.
They're not mainstream. No, no, and they're going to be playing Wembley for it. They played Wembley in the UK, got a big, like,
which
sold out.
They never did in the 80s.
No. And there's a big, and it's interesting because I went to one of their concerts 10 days ago, and what was interesting was the audience was half, you know, 60-year-olds, as you would expect, people in their 30s, 40s, and quite a lot of young teenagers. And it transcribes that one of their tracks, I think it's Off Your Face, has been a hit on TikTok, and it's been a trend. And so they would normally never play that track, but because of that, they've actually added it to their set list. So I think that's interesting how that kind of is still going to impact a band who normally doesn't really care. It's kind of very cool. And are going to play it because they know their audience are interested in this song.
Ulysse Hennessy, this is a phenomenon that began with the advent of YouTube. I have a friend who's into doo-wop music. He says, the music I like is from 1958. I can hear more music from 1958 than people who lived in 1958. How does social media change all of that, TikTok and the likes?
It changed a lot. And when we're talking about hits, we're obviously talking about charts too. And the charts now are way more crowded with older songs than they used to. And
older songs make it into the top 10 today?
To the top 10, top 100. And especially what we've seen now is like longer lasting of the hits. Like they last so long that Billboard has been changed the rules. And now if you're behind a certain position, after a certain number of weeks, you go out of the charts, basically.
So, for instance, when there was last year the new season of the Netflix series Stranger Things, and they played Kate Bush's Running Up That Hill. After a while, you have to take it out because that's a song from the 80s. But
okay, so two different things. So it depends of when the song enters the charts first. So like, for instance, like if the song is in the charts for several weeks, then it goes out. But if the song was out for a long time and then comes back again, then you start from zero, you know? But yeah, it's a phenomenon we've seen, and especially in the, because of streaming, basically, because before, you know, let's say the radio played 40 songs at the same time. These were the 40 songs that were on competition for the charts. But now, let's say the TikTok algorithm, which is the new king, it puts every song of every period of history in competition. So your 2025 song is in competition with like a 50s song, a 60s song. And so now it's been much, much harder for a new song to break. And on another point, older songs have a much bigger chance than before.
So the diktat of things that are familiar, Liv Monahan.
Yeah, I'm lapping all that up. I think that's really interesting. I think it's super interesting how the old songs, you know, are making this comeback again because of the familiarity. But also, just to go back to your original point, I think it's because they're organic. I think people are craving this sense of, I liken it a little bit to when vintage clothes became really popular. I think people were just craving this sense of realness, you know, clothes that were made by hand or that had a story, you know, like not this mass production that we have today. And I think it's the same thing with music. People are looking for that. The stories that I spoke about as well, people are looking for that because that brings great comfort. Human beings bring great comfort, you know, that, you know, the kind of great kind of robots and the capitalism doesn't.
Can old songs tell the story of a young generation?
I think stories are universal. So I think, I mean, I've got great comfort from, you know, music from the 1800s. I don't think that that's the issue. People, like young people, love, you know, the Beatles and Kate Bush today. So I do think that it's really just like love and Christmas and all of these things that we're talking about are universal themes. I don't think that when they're created is really the issue. You know, I just think people are attracted to this organic warmth,
so
I feel.
This, as was explained by Ulysse, this huge offer now, very eclectic. People, as a result, they see everything, they gravitate towards the familiar. Richard, just tell us, what was your experience listening to hits, listening to songs when you were young compared to what it is now?
Oh, it's, I mean, the truth is I wasn't listening to hits when I was young. I was listening to jazz.
But there are hits there too, all the ditties composed by Duke Ellington and the likes.
Yeah, you know, the writer Alex Ross has an essay kind of about this idea of finding pop music later in life and how, and, you know, having gone to a conservatory and played a lot of gigs in my 20s, discovering pop in my 30s now is like this exciting practice. It's an exciting exercise because I'm listening for the form, I'm listening for the melody, and I'm have this, you know, I have kind of an analytical approach to it, which maybe is not always the most organic way to enter the music, but it's when I listen, I think about it. I never danced to these pieces, and I don't really have a reference for what it's like to hear it in its time.
So in the 1980s, there was a famous television show here in France where the prolific singer-songwriter, composer Serge Gainsbourg played Chopin on the piano and said, "That's major art. What I do is minor art." Is there a distinction to be made, or is it all the same?
Oh, I think it's all the same. I mean, you know, Eric Satie was writing music for Edith Piaf, and you know, I think there's always this exchange between high and low art, and I think, you know, I envision those people kind of going to the same parties.
Marjorie Hash, again, we're asking about things that are comforting or things that are scary. The fact that, again, what Ulysse was saying about gravitating towards what you know, that's always been the case.
Yes.
But is it more so today?
I think so to some extent. I mean, I'm a geriatric millennial, so I kind of grew up with the period where you had the radio, and if you wanted to get new music, you had to go to the record store and listen, or you had friends and you would exchange mixtapes or CD tapes. And then the arrival of internet. I mean, I'm very envious because you can go and look up as many things as you want and find things. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of people will. Not everyone, luckily, but a lot of people will just be happy to follow what algorithms are. I remember being on streaming platforms and being like, I don't want this, and getting annoyed. But I know other people are really happy and they discover our artists like that. But a lot of it kind of it, I feel like it feeds into an echo chamber. And maybe if you want lots of different kinds of music, then you could find it frustrating. So yeah, there is a turn to comfort and what you already know as well.
Ulysse Hennessy, do you sometimes listen to music and think, that is not a hit,
yes,
and yet mm-hmm. it becomes one?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Like, also, right now, it's become more unpredictable than before, because yesterday's hits, they were made for radio. So you had, like, a structure that was created especially for radio. Whereas now, as TikTok makes song breakthrough with only 15 seconds loop, the 15-second loop that will make a song break can come from any type of song. So right now, it's become more difficult than ever to predict what will be a hit.
So I grew up. I'm not like a, what did you call
geriatric
it?
Geriatric millennial.
I'm not a. I don't know what's older than a geriatric millennial, but that's what I am. So when I grew up, you saved your money, you bought a vinyl, and then when you put it on, you listened to the whole of the side, you put it again and listened again if you liked it. Does anybody listen to an entire album anymore?
Yeah. I think, like, right now there's a great divide. I would say that there's a divide that's increasing again. It's between the super fans. I would say that they are the ones who will stream all the album, buy the ticket for the concert, who will buy the merchandising. And on the other hand, lots of people who are doing what we call passive listening. And they don't really think about what they're listening. They just, you know, put play on a playlist and just don't really think about the music they're listening to.
Which has always been the case, right, Richard Sears?
Yeah, I'm thinking about what Marjorie just said. I'm also sort of some version of a millennial, and, and there was a moment when I was a teenager when I would buy all the CDs and be very invested in everything. And then as soon as I got to college, someone gave me a hard drive and said, "Okay, this is everything that Radiohead ever did and everything Keith Jarrett ever released." And, and that was the end of very invested listening. With that kind of access, I think. That immediate access.
So you're saying it'd be better if there was less access?
I like the idea that you have to invest something, not always money, but something of yourself, time, to gain something deeper from the music.
People take music more for granted, Liv Monahan, you agree?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting one, actually. And just, this is related, I think, but the idea that the older music, I do think, let's say the Beatles, for example, is pure pop, but I would say it's a more sophisticated pop than the pop we have today, which is very, very, very simple, you know? And what I just think is interesting is that the passive listening, you know? But what I'm worried about is people are passively listening to stuff that's not of as high a quality as what they were passively listening to 50, 60 years ago. You know, if I hope what I'm saying makes sense, but I
are you sure it's not people remembering a golden age that never was? Because I remember growing up in the 1970s, you had to listen to the radio and you had to listen to a lot of bad songs.
Fair enough. Yeah, of course. And I suppose I'm
my children thinking... only get to hear the great ones. So they say, oh, music was fantastic in the 70s.
Right, but I'm looking at I know it's the whole arena has changed so much, but look at what's making it to number one today, or, you know, the big hits. And if I think about the sophistication of the likes of Joni Mitchell and the Beatles, they were pop you know, musicians. So I just feel that we're actually doing ourselves an injustice, really, or our people should be aware of this. Like, what are you listening to? Because it's forming your musical intelligence. You know, and I feel that that's a real shame with all of these formula and how to make a pop hit and everything, because it's become so capitalistic. People, and removing the human from it, of course, pushes that further. You're moving further away from it having any sort of soul or spirit. And I do think that's at the detriment, actually, of the listeners, ultimately. You know, you're making music for people and folk. It's all folk music. It's for communities. And I feel that today, in the pop sphere anyway, it's too focused on, like we said, the Christmas hit. How do we make some money from this? What are all of the kind of boxes we need to tick? And I do think that's changed. Yes, we have the super fans. So that's actually making music a little bit more elitist. So we have these small group of super fans who are really listening to music, or they're being more discerning.
Going to every concert.
Absolutely. And you know, that I think that's also separating the masses out from people with money, you know, maybe to kind of put it crudely. And I feel that in the 70s was a brilliant age for music. You know, it was before we'd got the synths were just coming in. So it was still very organic. And I do think that the quality of the music, the actual compositions, was of a higher standard generally than the pop hits that we have today. That's, I stick on that. And I'm not from that era.
The 70s didn't have AI, but they did have Muzak, which was the stuff you heard in elevators. I'm sure that would that would test your... let's talk, because you talked about soul and spirit. And with a little time left, you know, what kind of music speaks to people in 2025? For the top songs globally of the year, English language songs rule. If you're looking at global charts, likes of Bruno Mars, Kendrick Lamar, Billie Eilish. Further down the list, there's more variety. Most notably, Puerto Rican reggaeton star Bad Bunny. We can listen to a sample from his hit single, which is also the title track from Debí Tirar Más Fotos. It's in Spanish. He's decided to pick up what Liv says and to cater to his own audience. It's by playing dates in Puerto Rico this year. He'll be at the Super Bowl. So your idea on this, does Bad Bunny represent what 2025 is all about?
I think it's interesting because it shows that people are more open to different languages in terms of song making. I mean, the Macarena was a hit in, you know, 1996, if you go that far. But you have Bad Bunny, you've got Rosalía as well, who's been pushing boundaries and also really making a name for herself, and she's always quoted as an influence by other artists. So I think that's probably an upside of the internet, is a greater exposure maybe for different languages. And you know, the Spanish language is such a huge one across the world that it would make sense that it would be a hit, I think.
Ulysse Hennessy?
And another detail that I feel is very great with the two albums you quoted is that they are concept albums, actually, revolving around one theme. And they are very ambitious albums. And that's another, I would say, advantage of the streaming era. It's that people and mass audiences can have this type of conceptual album and, you know, find them very accessible in some way.
And you have also songs from other languages. You have hits from sub-Saharan Africa in French and local languages. Before, you had to come to Paris sometimes to record an album. You don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, and we have other continents too. You have, for instance, K-pop, Korean music that's exporting worldwide. You have music from Africa, like Afrobeats, which is exporting worldwide too. So I think that's what's defining this era too, is that local hits can go global too. And it's not only English-speaking songs that can go global now.
Quick final question. Richard, what kind of song for 2025?
Oh, what kind of song for 2025? you know, in reference to an artist or?
Just what kind of song should be made for 2025 or 2026, I should say.
I mean, I'm more and more a Luddite these days. I want to hear something recorded to tape. I want to hear something where you feel the texture in the music. I'm really impressed by the last record by this singer named and pianist named Eliana Glass. That's my record for 2025.
Liv Monahan?
Something inspiring for 2026. I just think more organic elements challenge people. You know, I'd love to see something topping it that was really unexpected without all of these, you know, kind of typical things that have been doing it up to now, up to recently. I'd love to be surprised. All right, in 2026.
Well, thank you for keeping it real, Liv Monahan. I want to thank as well Eudice Hennessy, Marjorie Hash, Richard Sears. Thank you for being with us here for this special edition of the France 24 debate.